And I'm a hunter, so I'm a beast of the mind, 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 mind. Tell me, baby, tell me, what am I to do? Baby, 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 oh, should I keep on loving you? When I go to bed, I try to get some sleep. I talk on it, wouldn't you know it, baby?
Hello, this is Tom Campbell, host of a series of interviews with local band members and music industry professionals from the 1950s, 60s, and 70s. Today's interview is with Mike Wagner of Mike Wagner and the Bops. Hello, this is Tom Campbell. Today is January 20th, 2013, and I'm talking with Mike Wagner from Mike Wagner and the Bops. Mike, if you don't mind, could you please tell us your full name, your date of birth, and your hometown, please?
Well, this is Mike Wagner. I was born in 1940, and October 12th, in case you want to send me a birthday card. I was born in Minneapolis.
What part of the Twin Cities did you grow up in?
Actually, I grew up in mid-northern Minnesota until I was about 15 years old, actually 14 years old. Lived on a farm in Pine County.
And when you came to the Twin Cities, what part of the Twin Cities were you in?
We landed in Richfield.
Okay. What is your earliest memory of being involved with music?
The earliest memories are actually back when I was 6, 7, 8 years old, because my dad was in the homespun music business. His oldest brother was an incredibly good fiddler. My dad's sister was an excellent singer, and back in the day they used to call it singing tenor, which was what we'd call today, we'd call it harmony. And she also could play rhythm guitar, so this is what we did.
What did your dad play?
He was a guitar player and a fiddle player.
Okay. And that piqued your interest in music?
Oh, of course. We just grew up with it. Yep, we sure did.
Do you remember how old you were when you got your first guitar?
I didn't get my own, like, ownership guitar until I was probably 12 or 13 years old. I would play my dad's guitar.
And did you play with your dad's band?
When I was about 10, Dad had one of my mom's uncles, who by marriage was my dad's uncle as well. They had a trio that played up in the woods up there, and they were called the Three Jacks or something like that. I can't remember what it was, but my Uncle Jack Fetty was a drummer. He lived down by Siren, Wisconsin. We lived up by Pine County, which was east of Hinckley. The accordion player, his name was Otto Simonson. He lived north of Danbury on Highway 35, 5 or 6 miles, and that was the three guys that used to go out and play dance jobs, and I started tagging along when I was about 10, and I would sing 4 or 5 tunes.
Do you remember what songs you would sing?
The only two I can remember were, you know, like Old Shep and some of the old country tunes that I could sing, and then, of course, I believe it was about 1949 or 50 when Hank Williams became a big deal. In fact, I think he died in January back in like 1960 or something. But at any rate, so there was some of the Hank Williams tunes that I could sing, like Lonesome I Could Cry and things like that.
And at some point, you wound up on TV, I understand.
Yes, I did.
How'd that happen, and what were the shows?
This lady that I referred to earlier, my dad's sister, she was bound and determined that I would get a chance to go out and play and sing and do some things. And we were still living on the farm, and she made arrangements to get me on the Toby Prince Show, which is on WCCO Channel 4. Then, like a week or two later, I was on Jimmy Valentine's talent show on Channel 5. And then one of the things I did that was kind of comical, David Stone, who also worked the Sunset Valley Barn Dance on Channel 5 and on KSDP Radio, I got on his show, and I was going to sing a Jimmy Dickens song called Sleeping at the Foot of the Bed. He wouldn't let me sing it because of the lyrics. I mean, Have things changed? Huh? Can you say yes?
So these were like talent contests.
Yeah. And I remember winning second prize on Tony Prince show to like a 5-year-old who tap danced.
Well, what did you win?
I was hoping you'd ask. I won a ping pong set. And they mailed it to me. It's pretty cool.
That's funny.
It is.
Okay, so what year did you enter high school then in Richfield?
I started part of the first class to graduate from Richfield High School in 58. So in the fall of 54, I would have gone into class as a ninth grader. The school was, I don't know if this is true or not, but it was thought to be like the second largest high school in the city at the time, or in the state at the time. And I went from Hinckley High School, Hinckley 8th grade, be called junior high now, with about 24 kids, to split shifts at Richfield.
Split shifts because of the large volume of people.
And they were still building the school, you know.
And what was going on musically at that point in the mid-50s?
Well, it was, you know, obviously the birth period of the stuff that I really grew up with, which was a very close cousin to the stuff my dad had been doing. He'd been playing country music, and that was pretty much what I knew about. I didn't know much about anything else. And then all of a sudden along comes Elvis Presley and Gene Vincent and Bill Haley, Johnny Cash and Carl Perkins and Fats Domino. And man, that was just like, whoa, I could do this.
And you would hear these artists on the radio?
Of course.
What station was playing them?
KDWB was still in its infancy at the time. But it would have been probably WLOL and WDGY playing this stuff. And then you'd hear it at night. I started to figure out, wow, if I go a certain place in the Twin Cities, I can listen to WLS in Chicago. I can listen to KHJ, I believe that's Pittsburgh, the Clear Channel stations. I can hear KOMA, Oklahoma City. It was just like a whole brand new world.
Do you recall where WLOL was located on the dial?
1330.
Okay, and that's obviously AM at that time.
Oh, of course.
And do you recall any of the DJs who were playing the new music?
The one that I recall the best, and I can give you more details if you wish, was Carl Peterson. Carl was the all-night jock at WLOL Radio. His father was a very well-known recording artist in Scandinavia, Ole Skrattholt. And by coincidence, that family lived next door to my aunt and uncle down on Fifth Avenue and 3100 block. I got to know Carl a little bit, and, you know, he was on the radio, and, you know, I was enamored by all of that. Yeah, and there are some names that I have forgotten, and I, you know, apologize to those who know them today, but these guys were all influential and helpful to me as some kid trying to learn how to play. And then, you know, you meet guys like Throckmorton, who was the visionary for Bash Land and basically lived in the transmitter room at the radio station.
And Bash Land was a club in St. Paul?
It was down in south parts of St. Paul. It was virtually out in the sticks at the time because it was just a barn. It was like they took the cows out and put the people in.
So tell us about the origin of Mike Wagner and the Bops, and what year did that come about?
I didn't have a band, so to speak, but there was a teacher at Richfield High School. I'm searching in my mind for his first name. Wesley Cole, who was a theatrics teacher and speech teacher and just a wonderful man. Because we were a brand new school, everything was being created that continues today. He created this thing for us, outgoing types, called the Variety Show. And I and a couple of buddies decided we were going to try out for the Variety Show. And I didn't have a band, but I did, and I sang an Elvis Presley tune or two, and, you know, as they say, the rest is history. Girl screamed and the whole thing. It was pretty cool. I would have been about 56.
Okay, and then eventually here you put a band together.
I did put a band together.
And who was in this first version of the Bops?
My dear brother, Collie, was our guitar player. He was like 14 at the time. And he also was a homespun player, learned to play, and was an incredible player. Dick Benedict was a rhythm guitar player with us. I had Doug Barton, who is still playing, and delightful saxophone player. Lyle Goodmanson was our drummer, another Richfield kid. Our bass player was Rusty Bates, and he played stand-up bass.
And you did all the lead vocals?
I did all the lead vocals.
Okay. What would have been some of the early songs that the Bops did at that time?
Well, I'm just going to take a shot here, boys, because I don't honestly remember specifically, but we would do stuff like Bebopalula, I Want a Lot of Lovin', I love the Gene Vincent stuff. We did Carl Perkins' Honey Don't, and we did Carl Perkins', of course, Blue Suede Shoes. We did some of the Presley stuff, including Love Me Tender, Heartbreak Hotel, My Baby Left Me, stuff like that. Bill Haley, we would, you know, I mean, I'm just kind of going down the playlist, boys, but that's what was going on.
Now, speaking of Gene Vincent,
yeah,
he had a song, Do the Bop, correct?
Exactly.
And that's...
Yes.
Where the name came from?
And I can tell you the story. We were playing at St. Richard's School on Penn Avenue South in about 72nd, I think, 73rd, something like that. And Carl Peterson, who I mentioned earlier, used to do record hops at Ford Hall in St. Paul and Laidlaw Legion Hall on Lake Street and Richfield Babcock VFW when it was in its original location on 65th and Lindale. And we were working a thing with Carl Peterson, and I had not yet had a name for the band. And we did a Gene Vincent song called Do the Bop. And he says, well, I got to introduce you. What's the name of the band? And I said, The Bops. And he said, okay, here we go.
Was that your first job?
Pretty much, yeah. In organized fashion.
Okay, and that was St. Richard's Catholic Church in Richfield.
Yeah, in the gymnasium.
I assume you start playing other venues at this point. Do you recall the other venues the band played at this time?
As I mentioned a little earlier, a dear friend of ours who befriended us and we him, Carl Peterson, had a lot of record hops going on at the time. And we played places like the Ford Union Hall in St. Paul, the Laidlaw VFW down on Lake Street, Bloomington Roller Rink. Was a real good shot for us because it was our hometown, and kids would show up for that. Green Door and Hopkins was another venture for youth, for young people to go. You know, places such as that. We played a little later on. We played Wakota Arena and South St. Paul and the Lion's Den and all kinds of joints like that.
Now, are you old enough to drive at this time?
I was, but I didn't have a vehicle that I could really depend on all that much. So every once in a while, you know, my aunt or my dad would drive us to the show, or one of the other fellas' moms or dads. I mean, our bass fiddle player, his mom always had to haul the bass fiddle around. And the drummer, his dad had a big station wagon, and he had to haul his stuff around. And I had an amplifier and a guitar and mic stand, so... Very shortly after I got licensed so I could drive.
Do you recall your first guitar and amplifier at this point?
Silvertone amp. The guitar, I believe it also was a Silvertone hollow body electric. And I got it from a little music shop down on Nicollet Avenue, and I think it was like 38th, 37th. It really was a violin shop, but the gentleman who owned it always had a few used guitars in there, so that's how I ended up getting it.
And did the band go through a change in the lineup here at some point?
Yeah, about 1958-59 when it started to actually click and work and people wanted to hire us and so forth. as I graduated in 58, so some of the guys went off to college and did other things, and I started to learn a little bit about what's going on in the business. So we trimmed down to a four-piece band. We picked up a guy by the name of Sheldon Hosse from Hopkins, who was an outstanding bass player. The big thing was these guys were free to travel. They could go out and do things. And so we started, you know, working around the state. And, my brother, Collie, and Sheldon, John Lentz, also from Hopkins, was our drummer, myself. So we trimmed it down to a four-piece band, pretty much just stuck with the rockabilly stuff, but we had to start recognizing that there were other forms of music. You know, Chuck Berry's not exactly a rockabilly artist, nor was Del Shannon, nor was some of these other guys. So we started to loosen up a little bit, adapt, and include some of the other forms of music that were starting to emerge.
Had you been out to the Crystal Coliseum to see bands play live there?
One answer is yes, one answer is not really, because I wasn't old enough to be at the Crystal Coliseum when some of the other bands were playing, like Augie Garcia and such, because they served alcohol. Bob Zimmerman, who owned the Crystal Coliseum, used to let me in once in a while, but, you know, I realize now as an adult that he probably did me a favor by allowing that to happen. We got booked in there on just reputation for his teen nights, which were usually Friday nights.
Can you kind of paint us a picture of what the Crystal Coliseum looked like?
Well, I believe, and I don't know that I can verify this, but I believe it was basically for roller skating and things like that. And it was cavernous. I mean, it was just a big, and there was like a balcony on the, would have been the end of the Crystal Coliseum that faced Bass Lake Road, I think it was on, or something. I can't remember exactly. It was a major thoroughfare going into Crystal, I know that. And
Highway 52.
Okay. Yeah, it goes over the railroad tracks or something there?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, anyhow, when you first come into the place, there was a ticket window either on the left or the right, as you would have in a roller rink. But if you went inside and right around, there were stairs to go up to, like, a balcony up there. That's where I'd get shuttled off to go up there if I was going to watch any of the bands when they were selling liquor. It was a big joint. And, you know, there was just not the sound enhancements and the things that are available now. I played there, and Del Winslow's band, before he became the Trashman, used to play there.
That's Jim Thaxter and the Travelers?
It could have been. I don't know if Del Winslow played with Jim Thaxter or not. But Del was a rhythm player for the Trashman. They had a band together before they became the Trashman, I'm quite sure. Anyhow, Damon Lee played out there, and then Bob used to bring in some acts also. Like, there was a guy out of Rochester that I snuck in to see one night called Satellite Dan. Augie, of course, was a fixture out there. I think the Del Ricos played out there. I believe the Dorados played out there. It was just a wonderful place for a band.
How about Roscoe and his
Roscoe and the Greenmen? I don't remember seeing them at Crystal Coliseum, but I remember seeing them at Danceland. And they were an incredibly good band. And they had a shtick, you know, the green hair and the whole thing.
We've had a number of musicians here that saw Mike Wagner and the Bops perform at the Crystal Coliseum. And they mention a piece of equipment called an Echoplex.
Yes. I owe that to a wonderful music store of the time, Torp Music in St. Paul. And we started doing business with them because we liked the magnetone amplifiers, and they were kind enough to basically give us some to use to introduce them into the marketplace. I think magnetone was part of the Hammond Organ Company, but I'm not sure about that. But anyhow, we had these big Maggies, and they were just fabulous amps. And then they got this thing in called an Echoplex, which was basically a recording head on a tape with a movable playback head. It then mixed the sound, and you could get this echo effect. And so we got one, and then
What did you use it on? What instrument?
The first one we had, we used on my brother's guitar.
Okay.
And he got that unbelievably good sound. And then we got a second one that we used on the vocals, so we had a pair of them.
Was that unique at the time?
I believe they were probably the first ones in the Twin Cities being used in our style of music, at least. I'm not an expert on other venues, but with rock and rollers, I'd say, yeah, I think so.
Did you get a light show at some point?
Well, I saw Roscoe and the Green Men at Danceland. They had a set of portable lights, and it just blew me away how wonderful these looked. So I'm a reasonably creative fellow, and we built a set. We used, and you guys are of an era, you remember dimmer switches on the floorboards of cars. They were real heavy duty, and they would handle a lot of power. So we had four dimmer switches. One was the master, and three, one was white, one was blue, and one was green or red or whatever they were.
So one of the band members would have to control the
John,
lights.
The drummer, would control the lights.
Now, were you being booked through an agency at this time?
We did most of our booking ourselves, but I was doing quite a bit of road work with a guy by the name of T.B. Scarning. And T.B. Scarning was in Bloomington, and he was hooked up with another outfit called Excose, X as in the letter, period, Cose. And he had a Los Angeles office, and he also was affiliated with William Morris out of Chicago. So he got us a lot of regional work.
What was it like going out of town playing? Was it different than playing in town?
It is different because, first of all, you don't have your regular fans, but the whole idea was, you know, pretty much of an adrenaline rush. It entailed us spending a lot more time on the road, and you got to get to the joint and you got to get home. So we got a bigger and better trailer, and we had bigger and better vehicles, and everything was good. And during that era, by the way, is when we had to upgrade our own sound system that we used, because most of the venues didn't have house sound or lights at the time. Most of the bands, most of the places were actually not set up for rock or amplified music. They were mostly set up for bands like Jules Herman and Frankie Shermack or the Six Fat Dutchman or somebody. So we knew, just based on our own hometown experience, that we had to have sound reinforcement for things. So one of my friends, Dick Schock, some years back, there was a very successful audio chain in the Twin Cities called Schock Electronics. And Dick Schock, who was the son of the founder and owner, liked our band and was a delightful man and was very helpful and helped us get the components and the things we needed, because we're pretty much making it on our own. Came up with cabinets with big speakers in them, and there was really no such thing as a powered board or anything in that era. So he recommended and then was able to get for us amps like you would use in a warehouse for a public address system. And they were basically bulletproof and a lot of power and would take condensation and cold weather and hot weather and so forth. And we used those big vocal amps powering our own sound system.